Good day. Today is Wednesday, 4th March 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. If, once you've watched or listened to this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch or listen to, and you decide that you like what you've heard, you wish to indicate that fact. Now, over the last 24 hours, judging from certain reports I received in the British media, it appears that the Iranian capital, Tehran, experienced the heaviest day of bombing in the war up to now. I say bombing, though I also understand that most of the attacks continue to be conducted with long-range missiles, perhaps from outside Iran's borders. But I'm not going to pretend that I have a completely detailed or complete understanding of ongoing military operations. But anyway, the strikes on Tehran, the attacks on Tehran yesterday, appear to have been on an astonishing scale. There was a report in the Daily Telegraph, a newspaper that is strongly supportive of Israel and which has consistently advocated a military assault on Iran, just to say, and which supports regime change in Iran. Anyway, this article in the Daily Telegraph, which, by the way, was extremely unpopular with a large section of its very, very pro-Israeli readership. Anyway, this article spoke about an apocalyptic situation of massive devastation in Tehran itself, of hospital buildings having been hit, of damage being done to civilian places, of civilian residential buildings being struck as well, of food queues and of people trying to dilute milk supplies in order to ensure that their children continue to receive milk, and altogether of an absolutely terrible situation in Iran yesterday. Now, I understand that the journalist who wrote that article is not located in Tehran, that he received his information from sources within Tehran. But, for the record, other British journalists who are indeed on the scene in Tehran gave perhaps less vivid, but nonetheless also pretty stark accounts of what took place in Iran yesterday. There was a similar lengthy article, for example, in the Financial Times, and there were shorter articles in the Guardian. Both the article in the Financial Times and the article in the Guardian also spoke about hospitals having been hit or damaged over the course of the bombing, and also spoke of extensive devastation in Tehran itself. And they also, importantly, at least in the Financial Times, gave some sense of what the targets, these specific targets that lay behind these missile and bombing strikes might have been. Because it seems that there has been a campaign to destroy police stations across Tehran, presumably with the intention of weakening the government's response in the event that large-scale protests against the government actually take place. The problem with that kind of strategy is that though the Financial Times found one person who was still critical of the government in Tehran, despite the bombing and the damage, and though there were perhaps rather more such people in a similar article and report by the BBC, Other reports, on the contrary, speak of a stiffening of resistance, a shock and dismay at the lengths to which the United States and the Israelis are taking this operation. There was one rather plaintive comment in the article in the Financial Times by a student who was identified as an opponent of the government. He asked what kind of country would he have when the war was over. He said that people like him in Tehran had expected specific attacks that would weaken the government, not the kind of wholesale destruction that seemed to be taking place. And he clearly was profoundly shocked by the scale of the devastation. So anyway, I mention all of this. I understand, perhaps, the logic of the attacks on the police stations. But it does seem to me that the attacks that took place yesterday, and apparently there were also heavy attacks on Monday on Tehran, though perhaps not quite as heavy as the ones that took place yesterday. Anyway, it seems to me that they are acquiring now a character which, and I have to say this, is starting to remind me of what took place in Gaza during the long conflict there, which, by the way, has not finished. And, well, at a political level, it's totally counterproductive. But at a humane level, at the level of humanity, it is completely devastating and appalling. And, well, I don't know that there's very much more I can say. Anyway, there it is. I should add that there are now several reports that important historic buildings in Tehran have also been damaged. The Golestan Palace, which is the palace of the Iranian Shahs, it was mostly built by the previous Qajar dynasty in the 18th and 19th century. It is the most historic and some say beautiful building in Tehran. I say some say because, of course, I've never been to Tehran myself. There's apparently further damage to the Tehran Bazaar, which is one of the other great historic buildings in the Middle East. It's richly ironic, some would say, given that the protests that took place in Iran in December and January actually began with protests by the merchants of this very bazaar. But anyway, to repeat again, apart from the death toll, the human devastation, the loss of civilian life, the damage to buildings, it seems to me that as a military operation, this makes no sense and is going to prove, in the end, based on all historical knowledge, all knowledge of these kind of attacks on urban centres, it is going to prove completely counterproductive. Now, many will say that my words in response to these events have been excessively restrained. I have attempted to maintain composure, though I have found it extremely difficult to do so over the last 24 hours as these reports have poured in. I remind myself that the key thing to do, even in the face of these events, these terrible events, is to maintain discipline and conduct analysis. But all I will say is, I was profoundly and deeply shocked by the reports that I read and some of the film which I have seen. Anyway, let's move on and discuss the other events in the war. Now, the big thing that's been taking place over the last 24 hours continues to be the effective closure of the Straits of Hormuz. Apparently, a grand total of three tankers managed to slip through the Straits of Hormuz before the Iranians fully closed them, but no others are moving. There's been no movement of tankers through the Straits of Hormuz for the last 2 days, and it doesn't seem as if there's going to be any movement of tankers, at least for a while. Yesterday, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, spoke about how the United States was going to provide insurance, the United States government was itself going to provide insurance to the various ship owners to enable the ships to start transiting through the Straits of Hormuz, and how escort duties for shipping through the Straits of Hormuz would soon be provided by the US Navy. Well, as to the first, there is no word so far on any insurance package from the US government having been provided. And I'm going to guess that in order for that to happen, there would need to be congressional authorization. That might take several days. And for the moment, at least, maritime insurance, mostly from London, for these ships has stopped. As for moving the US Navy to the Straits of Hormuz and to the Persian Gulf to conduct escort duties, well, as I say many times, I am not a military expert, but I would have thought that this contained very significant risks. One of the reasons why the Iranians have not so far been able to inflict any damage on any American warships is because most of them are located in the Arabian Sea. They are continuously in motion. The Iranians have launched missiles occasionally trying to strike them, but as many have agreed and have been saying for some time, it is extraordinarily difficult for missiles to hit moving targets, and so far the Iranians have been unsuccessful. If the United States starts to move warships to the Straits of Hormuz and to the Persian Gulf, then they become easily observable by the Iranians. They would reduce their ability to manoeuvre. They would be, in other words, in precisely the position where I would have thought Iran would be best positioned to conduct strikes against them. Again, let me repeat, I am not an expert in these matters. It may be that the US Navy has particular tricks up its sleeve. I don't know about such things, but it seems to me that any deployment of US warships so close to the Iranian shores, within easy range of Iranian anti-ship missiles and other sorts of missiles, and of course drones, of which, so far as I can see, Iran has virtually unlimited quantities. Well, that does seem to me to be risky. It seems to me that taking that kind of step would cause the risks for American warships exponentially to multiply. Now, it has been pointed out by several commentators that during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s, at a time when both Iran and Iraq were taking action, striking and destroying shipping in the Persian Gulf that was transporting the oil of each of these countries. The US Navy at that time did provide escort duty for ships that were transiting through the Straits of Hormuz. However, that was a completely different situation. The United States was not a direct participant in the war between Iran and Iraq. There was no secret for many people that the United States heavily sympathized with Iraq and was providing Iraq with extensive assistance. But the United States itself was not directly attacking Iran, and the Iranians, who obviously did not want the United States, with its enormous power, to join the war, had no interest or incentive in attacking US warships. This time, it will be different. Moreover, I am going to suggest that there has been a significant shift in the overall military and technological balance since the 1980s. In the 1980s, Iran did not have the capabilities to inflict significant damage on the US fleet or on US military assets. Today, it seems that to a certain extent at least, it does. It has much more effective and powerful missiles than it did then. It has drones, and of course drone warfare did not exist to any degree, or at least to nothing like this degree, the degree that we are seeing now, in the 1980s. The fact that the Iranians are able to inflict damage can be seen right across the Middle East, where they have been able to do significant damage already to US bases, to US military installations in places like Qatar and the UAE and in Bahrain. And, well, I would have thought, for all of these reasons, that an escort operation by the US Navy in the Persian Gulf, in the Straits of Hormuz, is going to be a far more problematic and complex and challenging and dangerous and difficult affair than it was in the 1980s. In fact, I suspect that comparisons between that operation and the kind of operation that is being talked about today are extremely unwise. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about that. The fact is that for the moment, oil supplies through the Straits of Hormuz and natural gas supplies are not moving. And in fact, we are getting reports that there has been a crash of production in oil production and natural gas production across the Middle East. Oil production in Iraq, and Iraq is a major oil producer, appears to have come to a total stop. Saudi Arabia continues to produce oil, and unlike the other Gulf producers, it has some pipelines that do enable Saudi Arabia to continue to export oil through other routes that avoid the Straits of Hormuz, though it should be said that the bulk of Saudi oil also has to be exported through the Straits of Hormuz. Anyway, apparently there's been some reduction in Saudi oil production, and I understand that much more worryingly, natural gas production in Qatar has come to a complete stop, and there's been falls in production of oil in the other Gulf oil producers, Kuwait, the UAE, and Qatar. Apparently, the crisis in natural gas production is even greater than the crisis in oil. The problems with LNG exports is that Qatar is the third biggest producer of LNG. There is apparently no scope to replace its production. The United States is mostly self-sufficient in natural gas. Russia, of course, also is. China does import LNG from Qatar in significant volumes, but China can probably ramp up imports of LNG from Russia. And here perhaps it's worth pointing out that the big Russian LNG production facilities and terminals are located in the Arctic, so that ships transporting LNG from the Arctic can, at least in theory, reach China via the Northern Sea Route through the Pacific coastline of Russia to China itself, avoiding international waters, sticking entirely to Russian and Chinese-controlled seas. And I suspect something like that will happen. But Europe, which has become critically dependent on LNG, is in a different position. And other Asian markets that also depend on LNG are in a very difficult position as well. If there is a prolonged cutoff of LNG exports from Qatar, then inevitably costs of natural gas around the world will surge. And I'm going to suggest that the region that is by far the most vulnerable is Europe, which of course has cut itself off from imports of Russian natural gas. Now, on the topic of oil and exports of oil, there is a narrative that has been circulating that one of the countries that is going to be particularly hard hit by the closure of the Straits of Hormuz is going to be China. Now, on this point, I should say that I've always been sceptical, but the indispensable Arnaud Bertrand has provided some clarity in a lengthy post that he has published on X. And Arnaud Bertrand has pointed out that China is 84% self-sufficient in energy. It produces oil and coal, and it uses coal very heavily, but is also the leader in nuclear power, the global leader in nuclear power. And it also, of course, has an extensive industry in terms of batteries, solar panels, and that kind of thing. Nonetheless, China does import a significant amount of oil, and it has imported oil from the Gulf, from Saudi Arabia and Iran, Saudi Arabia being a bigger exporter of oil to China than Iran is. However, even saying that, even allowing for that, the Chinese have recently been importing more and more oil from Russia. Some of that oil reaches them by pipeline. The Russians are absolutely in a position where they can provide China with more oil. In fact, Russia can satisfy all of China's needs for oil. Some Russian oil is heavier than the light crude that the Gulf producers supply, and that is a problem for China. I understand that there is a lack of refining capacity in China, but these do not seem to me to be overwhelming problems, given that China is 84% self-sufficient. The China stockpiled oil before the start of the conflict. Apparently, Chinese stockpiles of oil are very large. And in a recent program, one I made about a week ago, I pointed out that people were misreading the large-scale movement of tankers with Russian oil to China. It was widely assumed that this was the result of India reducing imports of Russian oil after the agreement that India had concluded with Donald Trump. I pointed out that it was far more likely to be a case of China stockpiling oil in light of the growing crisis in the Middle East and the strong likelihood that there would be a closure of the Straits of Hormuz. I would suggest that that is exactly what happened, and I would suggest also that this stockpiling by China of oil was a good case of prescience and planning, one not matched, by the way, by the United States, which went straight into this conflict with its oil reserves at a significantly low level, below the 500 million barrels, which I believe is what the United States ideally wants its strategic reserve to be. Anyway, China has, as I said, a significant stockpile, and it can ramp up production from Russia. It's 84% self-sufficient in energy. It will find ways to keep going. Other Asian importers of oil, Japan, the Philippines, are in South Korea, are in a much more critical position. I understand that Japan imports 90% of its oil from the Gulf, and all of it, or almost all of it, passes through the Straits of Hormuz. Japan, of course, is an ally of the United States. So is South Korea. But again, I'm going to suggest that if there is going to be a critical oil shortage over the next few weeks, the most vulnerable places will be Europe. The Indian government is supposedly considering ramping up imports of Russian oil to make up for any supply shortages from the Gulf. It's extraordinary how we've gone from a narrative just a few weeks ago of India reducing its imports of Russian oil to a narrative now of India increasing its imports of Russian oil in light of the ongoing crisis. Supposedly, the Indian government has asked the United States to green light India's decision to import Russian oil. I am very skeptical, by the way, about the last. I would have thought that the Indians would just go ahead and do it. And I wonder why they would want to discuss it with the United States, which it seems to me is in significant disarray on the tariff front anyway, in the light of the Supreme Court's recent tariff decision. Anyway, I'm not going to get into a debate about that at the present time. But yes, some of the US's Asian allies might be hard hit by energy shortages, oil and gas shortages. But again, I cannot help but think that the place where the greatest crisis is going to be Europe. Europe, if this thing continues for many more weeks, is going to find itself in an exceptionally difficult position, energy-wise. Now, it tends to get forgotten that there were lots of reports circulating in the media, mostly, it must be admitted, the Russian media, but they were never denied. And in fact, in a few places, I saw them confirmed. Anyway, there were lots of reports just a few weeks ago about how the natural gas reserves, Europe's natural gas reserves, were running at a reduced level at the start of this year. No one was suggesting that it was a crisis, but now perhaps one might want to reconsider that. If there's going to be shortages, global shortages of LNG, global shortages that are bound to affect Europe, and which are inevitably going to lead to a major spike in the price of LNG exports to Europe from the United States, then the fact that there are shortages, that there are rather not so much shortages, that the natural gas reserves in Europe are running at a reduced level is undoubtedly going to be a problem, even if perhaps crisis might overstate things. And as for the United States itself, well, the United States is energy self-sufficient. It produces oil and it produces gas. But as I've discussed in many programs, the global energy market is fungible. In other words, if there's major increases in prices around the world, it is going to be very difficult indeed for the United States, with its open economy, to prevent those increases, those surges in prices, energy prices, from feeding in to the American economy itself. And of course, if energy prices start to grow in the United States, then that inevitably is going to lead to higher inflation in the United States. All this in the run-up to what were, for the president and his party, already looking like difficult midterm elections in November. So this closure of the Straits of Hormuz is a problem. Yesterday, when the president spoke about the United States, the Navy, the US Navy providing escorts, and the US providing insurance for ships, there was a brief stabilization and even fall in energy prices, and also a stabilization of what had up to that time been, shall we say, a nervous mood in global stock markets. Well, as the hours passed and as market operators thought more about this, one got the sense that the reassurance that the president provided somewhat faded. And this morning, in Asian markets in particular, there was again steep falls. I understand that things have again stabilized a little. I suspect that a lot of market players are saying to themselves, well, let's see how long this situation continues, whether perhaps a deal is going to be done, whether the war is going to end, whether Iran might indeed collapse, or whether the president is able to follow through with his promises about marine insurance and naval escorts for tankers. But if in a week's time the situation remains essentially as it is now, then my prediction is that things are going to go from bad to worse, and we're going to start to see significant rises in energy costs over the next few weeks. And though we are entering the warmer period of the spring and summer, so that energy use is going to be less, which is going to dampen the rise in energy costs, it would still lead to higher inflation in the run-up to the November election midterms. And of course, it puts Europe in particular in a very difficult position come the autumn and winter. Anyway, that's one thing that is happening in the war. For the rest, and I'm going to say this, if one discounts what happened yesterday over Tehran, I am starting to get the increasing sense that this conflict is indeed metastasizing into a long duration one. Now, I say that, of course, there are many uncertainties. The president and his officials continue to insist that there are no shortages of missiles, of missile interceptors, and precision guided weapons. Others have done the maths. They've looked at production rates of all of the various missiles and the rates of expenditure, and they come to a completely different conclusion. And by the way, and for the record, I think they are right. And that isn't even introducing into this issue the joker in the pack, which could be a Chinese decision to start restricting exports of rare earths, something which must be hanging over this crisis all the time. I will return, incidentally, to China and its policies shortly. But nonetheless, the war goes on, the attacks continue. There were undoubtedly use of B-2 bombers to conduct raids inside Iran. There's been pictures provided of them. It's not clear to me exactly what they attacked. There are reports that the old lumbering B-52 bombers from the 1950s are also being deployed against Iran as well. Whether they're actually entering Iranian airspace to carry out heavy bombing from there, I simply don't know. And I'm not going to try and speculate. If they are, then it would be a sign that the Iranian air defense system is indeed very heavily degraded. But in the meantime, the Iranians, for their part, continue to strike at targets at American bases and facilities across the Middle East. And in what I thought was a serious sign of concern, the United States appears to have embarked on a wholesale withdrawal of all its diplomatic staff and the temporary closure of its embassies across the Middle East, which inevitably the governments of some of these countries are going to see as abandonment. Anyway, the president and his officials continue to be provide all kinds of contradictory explanations of the reasons for starting this conflict at this particular point in time. there's been much commentary about Secretary Rubio's claim that the United States attacked Iran because Israel was about to do so. A claim which, by the way, Secretary Rubio has walked back. There's also many claims that the president and his officials are providing a constantly shifting series of explanations as to what the ultimate objective in this war is. On the last point, I would say that is completely wrong. The president and his officials are coming up with all sorts of different explanations because they can't straightforwardly say what the actual one is and has been all along, which is regime change. The president and his administration, or at least the dominant groups within his administration, the people who are in the ascendancy within the administration, clearly decided long ago, before the June 2025 war, what their objective was. It is regime change. That was what they attempted in the June 2025 war. That is what was attempted again with the December-January protests in Iran. And that is what is being attempted once more now. The problem the president and his officials have is that they are not able to provide a legal case to justify their objective for regime change. A legal and a moral case. And it is the difficulty of explaining that which is causing the problem. But the objective to achieve regime change in Iran has always been there. I have come to the conclusion that the president himself agreed this with the Israelis and with some of his donors and supporters during the 2024 election. And when he was inaugurated, he was already fully committed to achieving that policy. So this is what this whole operation is all about. After the failure of the June 2025 war, which I said was a regime change war when it was conducted, I said that the business of regime change remained unfinished, remained undone, and that guaranteed that there would be a further attempt made over the next few months. I thought that it might be made before the end of last year. I think in some ways the protests were that attempt. When that failed, we've seen this massive deployment of military forces to the Middle East, and the objective of that deployment was to facilitate regime change in Iran. Now, the probable strategy, and it's perhaps worth reiterating that I do not have access to the internal discussions within the administration. The Pentagon does not share its plans with me, just to say. Anyway, the probable plan, the plan that makes overwhelming sense to me, is that the intention was, as it was in June, to eliminate Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, as many of the other key officials in Iran as possible. And the assumption was that this would create a power vacuum in Iran, leading to the implosion of the government. I suspect that one of the rationalizations that was circulating amongst the regime change community in Israel and the United States after the failure of the June 2025 war was that though Israel succeeded in killing a large number of senior Iranian officials, they failed to kill the most important one of all, who was Khamenei, and that this time killing Khamenei would be made the priority on the assumption that without Khamenei, the entire system in Iran would be headless and would quickly unravel. Now, that has not happened. We have not yet seen, we have seen in fact no sign of a disintegration of the government in Iran in that way. And here I'm going to say a few things. Firstly, I was reading a very interesting article about Khamenei, which was published in the Iranian media. I read it yesterday. And it said that Khamenei, as well as being a rather ascetic individual, made it a particular point of policy and lifestyle that he would live a life very much out in the open, that he would not hide in bunkers or in secret locations or surround himself with elaborate security measures and armed details, because he felt, he strongly felt, and took his cue from his predecessor, the founder of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, that in order to retain legitimacy, in order to keep a proper grasp and feel of the situation in Iran, the supreme leader had to live as close to the wider population in a simple and as straightforward a way and in an as accessible way as possible. Khamenei's predecessor apparently made a point throughout the Iran-Iraq war of remaining in Tehran, of occupying his usual residence, of avoiding staying in a bunker, because he felt that it was essential through that war to convey to the Iranian people that he was sharing their dangers and their suffering. And apparently Khamenei, very much Khomeini's disciple, chose intentionally to do the same thing. There's been a brilliant article in Unheard by an American commentator, Arta Moeni, who, by the way, I was privileged to meet last year in Georgia, during my trip to Georgia, and who understands Shiism and Iran very well. Anyway, there's a brilliant article that explains again how all of this works and how for Khamenei and for the entire political system in Iran, his death through, as they would say, martyrdom, is a major re-legitimizing factor, and that it will have strengthened and consolidated the entire political system in Iran all over again. And I should say that I've also had an email from a member of the Duran community who is based in Nigeria, who's an engineer based in Nigeria, who's written another brilliant article about how Khamenei's reach as a religious leader extended far beyond Iran's own borders and brought in Shia communities right across the Middle East, in Africa, and around the world. So if the assumption was in Jerusalem and Washington that eliminating Khamenei was going to result in regime change, that this somehow would solve the problem of why regime change didn't happen following the decapitation strike in June. Well, as of today, that looks like a miscalculation. And that may explain what looked to me like all sorts of steps that the administration is now taking as it tries to find its way through a crisis that is different from the one that it had previously imagined. So whereas the messaging before the attack on Iran was that the attack would be a short, easy conflict, now the narrative has turned to talking about a long war. I've seen reports that the administration, realizing the increasing financial cost of this operation, is now debating turning to Congress for an appropriation to continue with this conflict, which is, of course, a clear sign that it expects it to continue for a long time. There's also reports that the United States is now attempting seriously to involve the Kurdish militias who are based in Iraq in this operation against Iran, to try to get the Kurdish militias to invade Iran, to try to conduct operations against the government there, to begin the process, if you will, of disintegrating Iran. And there are even some claims that the United States is trying to persuade the Aliyev government in Azerbaijan to do the same thing. And lastly, we now have a drumbeat of reports that the United States is reconsidering the previous decision to rule out deploying boots on the ground, that at some point, some kind of invasion force of Iran is going to be put together. Though again, for what precise objective, it is extremely difficult to say. I have also seen polling coming out of the United States. Robert Barnes was kind enough to send me the results of an opinion poll, which showed decisive majorities of Americans opposed to this conflict. And perhaps most alarmingly for the president himself, a clear majority of Republicans opposing this conflict also, and saying that the president has gone back on the promise he repeatedly made during the during the 2024 election campaign, to keep the United States out of wars. So the president, looking for a long war, for the moment, at least having to face the possibility of a long war, having to turn to Congress for funding, and he probably has support in Congress for the moment to obtain funding, having to start making overtures to Iraqi militia units, and having to even contemplate the possibility of the US military being involved in ground operations inside Iran. All of this because the initial assumption that regime change would happen quickly is not being realized. And it's clear to me that there's not been unanimity within the administration itself about this operation either. There's been many comments about the ambiguous position that the Vice President J.D. Vance is taking. His long silence after the operation began, the fact that he did not join with the president himself in the room where the president was being briefed in the first few hours of the conflict about the progress of the operation, of the vice president, on the contrary, observing things from an entirely different location, the Situation Room in the White House, where he had Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, who's also widely believed to be skeptical of this operation. And interestingly, the US Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, that they were there. And, well, there's been commentaries about the vice president's skepticism, extensive commentaries about this in the British media, which do make me wonder whether some people in London who are far from happy with the development of this war, which, for the record, they see as a diversion from the war that really matters, which is the one against Russia in Ukraine, just saying, whether they might be hoping that at some point the Vice President, J.D. Vance, will step in and bring everyone in Washington to their senses. But there was perhaps an even more public sign of scepticism as well, and this came from the Assistant Secretary of Defense, Elbridge Colby. He gave testimony to Congress. I watched it very carefully. I noticed that Colby went against the whole constructed narrative now that there was an imminent threat from Iran, or that the operation was about achieving regime change in Iran. He seemed to be speaking as if he wanted this thing over and done with as quickly as possible. And to be clear, Colby is in no sense soft. He is somebody who absolutely, clearly, strongly believes in the importance to maintain US primacy. What he wants, however, is to focus on the defence of the heartland of the Western Hemisphere and in the Asia-Pacific region. Just as he has been critical of those within the United States who have been obsessively focused with Russia and Europe and who have therefore wanted to continue to shovel assistance to Ukraine. So I get the sense that Colby is equally skeptical about those who are obsessed with Iran and with the Middle East and who want to continue to shovel military aid to Israel and who want to assist Israel in its various operations, including the current one against Iran, also at the expense of focusing on the theatres that Colby believes are the truly important ones, the Western Hemisphere and the Middle East. Well, there it is. For the moment, and it's important to stress this, the hardliners, the anti-Iran hardliners, remain in the ascendant. It could be that as problems with the oil prices start to bite, especially if this has an effect on the financial markets, and also as the depletion of US arsenals accelerates, it could be that the pendulum in the administration will shift and that we will start to see people in the administration start to rethink this thing, and that the president himself might begin to become increasingly nervous and willing to reconsider. But for the moment, he remains completely committed to it. He initially made some overtures to the Iranians about beginning negotiations. As I said, in a recent program, Iran, the man who's running things in Iran, Larijani, said no. Since then, the president has, as he always does, doubled down. The White House has issued an extraordinary statement talking about removing the terrorist regime and all of that. But it's perhaps worth pointing out that the president himself, during the June 2025 war, spoke about forcing Iran into unconditional surrender, of being the objective of that war. And then, of course, he pulled back from that when it became clear that it would not be achieved. And it was Israel that was suffering increasing damage from Iranian missile strikes. So perhaps one shouldn't place excessive weight on what the president is saying. But for the moment, he remains committed. He continues to insist, as I said yesterday, that there are no shortages of key weapons. I think those, as I said, who've done the maths can clearly see that they are. He is raging against his predecessor, Joe Biden, for giving all the weapons to Ukraine. In fact, he said this now on many, many occasions, and he's been incredibly rude about the Ukrainian president, Vladimir Zelensky, in ways that clearly show his fundamental disinterest in the Ukrainian conflict and his anger at the way in which weapons were diverted to help Ukraine instead of doing the thing that he really cares about, at least at the moment, which is fighting Iran. And of course, he's also raging at some of the European leaders. He's raging at Prime Minister Starmer of Britain, who, in the incredibly weak political position in which he finds himself, is unable to join the United States and Israel in offensive operations against Iran. Were Starmer to try to do that, that would be the moment when he would cease to be Prime Minister, just saying. And he is raging, the President is also raging, against Prime Minister Sanchez of Spain and Spain altogether, because the Spanish have had the effrontery to criticise this operation, as, by the way, has France, and are saying that they won't become involved. And the president is now threatening some kind of economic blockade against Spain. I'm not sure how that works legally, by the way, given that Spain is a member of the European Union. But anyway, that's what he said. And incredibly and bizarrely, the president is receiving support in this from none other than Chancellor Merz of Germany, who's just been to the United States. Merz is a very, very long-standing and very devoted supporter of Israel. So that he supports this operation against Iran is not surprising. But incredibly, Merz seemed to support economic coercion by the United States against Spain, an EU country, a country, in other words, within the same economic bloc as the one that Germany purports to lead. I'm not going to waste time trying to unravel the absurdities and contradictions of all of that. When someone talks in this way, when he behaves in this strange fashion, as President Trump is doing, trying to stir up Iraqi militias, saying all of these extraordinary things about Starmer and Sanchez and Britain and Spain, I can't help but think that he's reflecting the immense anger and frustration and stress he privately feels because the desired objective in Iran of regime change has not been fulfilled. Well, here I'm going to also say a few things about the BRICS powers. Now, there's a narrative circulating that China is putting pressure on Iran to reopen the Straits of Hormuz. This is not true, actually. This is how the Chinese Foreign Ministry explains China's position. In response to a media question that Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps had claimed that they currently control the Strait of Hormuz, an important route for oil and gas transportation, and had noted that any vessel attempting to pass through the strait could be subject to missile or drone attacks, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said that the Strait of Hormuz and its surrounding waters are important international channels for cargo and energy trade, emphasizing that safeguarding security and stability in this region is in the common interest of the international community. China urges all parties to immediately cease military operations, avoid further escalation of tensions, prevent further turbulence, and avoid causing greater impacts on the global economy. So what the Chinese are saying is that what needs to happen is not for Iran to give up, to stop blockading the Straits of Hormuz, but for everyone to stop. For Iran, obviously, to stop, but for the United States and Israel to stop also. For there to be a complete cessation of hostilities, for the United States and Israel, in other words, to give up the project of regime change in Iran. And if you go to Russian statements, they are saying exactly the same. As I discussed in my program yesterday, Putin and MBS, the Crown Prince and Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, had a telephone conversation yesterday. The Russian readout is actually quite interesting. It clearly floats the possibility of eventual Russian mediation. And rather interestingly, the proposal seems to have come ultimately from MBS himself. I'll read the Russian readout. Both sides express serious concern over the real risks of geographical expansion of the conflict, which has already affected several Arab states and is fraught with potentially catastrophic consequences. In this regard, Vladimir Putin emphasized the need to resolve the extremely dangerous situation at hand via political and diplomatic means. In turn, Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud opined, in the words suggested, that the Russian side could presently play a positive stabilizing role given the friendly ties it has with both Iran and the Gulf states. So one can understand MBS's position, which is the position of all of the other Gulf states. They depend on exports of energy products. They are their lifeline. The United States, Europe, might experience China, Japan, they might experience significant problems if the energy flow through the Straits of Hormuz remains indefinitely stopped. But for the Gulf states, this is an existential matter. Energy exports are their lifeblood. So MBS, according to many reports, privately urged Trump and the Americans to go ahead with this operation against Iran. He probably assumed, as many others did, that Iran would implode very quickly as soon as Khamenei had been killed. He now has reasons to fear otherwise, and he's looking to the Russians to conduct mediation. Now, I should say that contrary to what many think, Russia does not have a great amount of experience in mediating conflicts. The last time I can remember when he did so successfully was in 1965, during one of the Pakistani-Indian wars, when the then Soviet Prime Minister, Alexei Kosygin, successfully mediated a cessation of hostilities between Pakistan and India at a meeting in Tashkent. But anyway, one can see how in time the Russians might become involved. And of course, if they do, they will milk this to their advantage. Already there are lots of reports saying exactly what I mentioned previously in an earlier program, that for the moment, for the Russians, this conflict comes for them with many advantages. Energy prices are rising. More countries are going to need Russian oil and gas, especially if the closure of the Straits of Hormuz continues for very long. Nobody in Moscow seriously believes that the Europeans are going to resume buying Russian oil and gas. And I don't get the sense that the Russians are that enthusiastic about selling oil and gas to the Europeans. But of course, in conditions of worldwide energy shortage, even Russia's favourite customers, India and China, are going to have to pay more, as other countries also will. Attempts to block Russian exports, likely before long, if this situation continues, are going to have to be abandoned. The United States is diverting all its weapons to the Middle East. Trump is complaining about the fact that weapons were sent instead, were wasted by being sent to Ukraine. That's going to leave Zelensky and his government in Ukraine short of weapons at the very time when the Russians are preparing their big spring offensive. So Moscow, Putin, already gains, has short-term gains, and if their services as mediators are requested, then of course they will seek to build on these short-term gains. They might start to make further demands, for example, not just about Ukraine, but about the recalibration of the security architecture in Europe. Just saying. But for the moment, I don't think that the Russians are going to rush to make themselves available as mediators. Nor do I think will the Chinese join them. The Russians will wait and see for the situation to ripen before they take such a step. If this conflict does indeed metastasize into a long conflict, which is Iran's strategy, then maybe the mood in Washington will shift, and that will be the moment for the Russians and perhaps the Chinese, but more the Russians than the Chinese, to step in. We are very far from that point yet. Iran, in the meantime, is said to be very close to announcing Hu Khamenei's successor as the new supreme leader is going to be. Iran also is far from guaranteed at the present time to come through this all intact. The forces that are attacking it are immensely powerful. And the conflict, in this conflict, Iran's own military power, though perhaps not inconsequential, is hardly such as it can balance the far greater striking power of its adversaries. So, for the Russians to intervene, for the Russians to act as mediators, firstly, they have to be sure that Iran will come through, and secondly, they have to be sure that the Americans, faced by the growing costs of the war, worried about the depletion of their arsenals, unable perhaps to counter Iranian missile strikes on Israel, and the Iranians are saying that they've not yet drawn on their arsenal of their most potent missiles. The Russians will need to be sure that the Iranians are in a sufficiently strong position where they look like a convincing negotiating partner and are prepared to negotiate. And one where the United States, having failed in its objective to achieve regime change and facing growing economic and military costs, is obliged to seek mediation, is in a weaker position, and is prepared to cut its losses and to stop. We are, to reiterate again, some way away from being there. Now, we have to be prepared for all sorts of things to happen. For the moment, Iran has held together. There is no guarantee, at least I cannot provide any guarantee, that it will. I still don't know the full realities of the internal situation in Iran. I do not know the size of Iranian missile stockpiles or of Iran's ability to keep replacing the missiles it uses and adding to its stockpile. I would have thought that the Iranians could probably continue to manufacture drones, pretty much whatever happens. If Ukraine can make drones, even as it is under missile and bombing strikes by the Russians, then presumably Iran can do the same. And there's always the potential of having the drones made in other places, in Central Asia, in China, in Russia too, if it comes to that, and having them sent into Iran itself. About missile production, I would have thought that the big factories are coming under significant attack now, and it might not be possible for the Iranians to replace their missile stockpiles. And that brings us back to the question of how big those missile stockpiles are. And then there are the uncertainties about the Kurds, and then there are the uncertainties about Azerbaijan. But for the moment, Iran stands. If this continues, and if this does metastasize into a long war, then, as I said, the balance changes and it shifts to Iran's advantage. But we are not there yet. We will probably start to get a better sense of where all this is going in, say, roughly 2 weeks' time. Until then, we must be prepared for any eventuality. All that I think we can say at the moment is that Iran has proved more resilient than the Americans expected, and we see the frustration and the worry in Washington start to grow. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about this conflict in the Middle East today. I repeat what I said at the start of this program. The events in Tehran yesterday seem to me to have been events of horror. And this is a completely unprovoked war, which I would describe as a war of aggression. There's a fine article about this in Responsible Statecraft by Anatole Levin, who damns the hypocrisy of European leaders who lack the courage to say this. But if I was to say with complete confidence that I knew what the outcome of this conflict would be, I would be saying a great deal more than I know. Now, I'm going to finish by quickly rounding off with the situation about Ukraine. It seems to me that for the moment at least, we can forget about negotiations. There is lots of talk about another massive Russian missile and drone strike on Ukraine being prepared. And, well, it looks as if Ukrainian positions in the north, in Slavyansk, are disintegrating. The Russians appear to have captured significant territories around Slavyansk, and it looks as if they're about to begin the operation to capture the key village near Slavyansk of Rai Alexandrovka, which is at the top of an important hill, which would enable the Russians to look down on Slavyansk and Kramatorsk and to interrupt the communications between the two. And it looks as if the Russian advance towards Orekhov continues. The difference, I should say, in the way this war, the war in Ukraine, is being conducted from the war against Iran is astonishing. The Russians continue a systematic, methodical military campaign. They have clear objectives. They're not overcommitting to the war. They're maintaining stability in their own internal economy. They're building up their diplomatic position. And they can be confident that eventually this war will end on their terms in a way that will put them in a position of advantage. This attack against Iran, by contrast, has an extraordinary, frenetic, violent quality. I would say almost a hysterical quality. In the midst of all the death and destruction and violence, which one can sense is the product of it being, in the end, a reckless gamble. Well, that's what I'm going to say today about the situation. There'll be more from me soon. In the meantime, just to remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to check your subscription to this channel and to tick the like button if you've liked this video. And the very last thing from me in these very difficult days is to wish you all, wherever you are, peace and safety and a very good day.